Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do audience cynicism and interactive media technologies change the relationship between companies and the people they want to sell to? Many of us can remember back to a time when we had no choice but to experience traditional advertising, at least if we wanted to be informed and entertained by the products of mass media. But today, we record what we want to watch, skip the commercials, and zip around the internet to locate only the content we're interested in. And we do all that in part because we have learned to distrust and dislike most efforts to persuade us to buy. So where does that leave companies with products and services to sell? How can they get the word out about what they have to offer without irritating the very consumers they want to attract? Michael Serrazio is here to talk about that. He is assistant professor in the Department of Communication at Fairfield University. His new book is called Your Ad Here, The Cool Sell of Guerrilla Marketing. Mike, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to join you today.
What is guerrilla marketing and how does it blur the lines between the once really discrete functions of advertising and public relations?
Sure thing. So guerrilla marketing is sort of my central metaphor for understanding a lot of the profound changes that are happening in the advertising world nowadays. As you mentioned in the intro, we were long accustomed to encountering advertising in conventional spaces and in traditional ways. You know, it showed up during the commercial break on television or surrounding the editorial content in newspapers. What we're seeing more and more as some of those conventional venues no longer act as robust in terms of reaching consumers is that advertisers are sort of trying to filter their message into non-traditional spaces, and that's blurring the lines of where we've encountered advertising content compared to previous decades. So guerrilla marketing really encompasses a lot of the explosion that we've seen in terms of product placement, branded content, buzz marketing, social media marketing, and a lot of these other new technological advances that the marketing industry has pioneered really over the past decade because, as you say, they're facing a number of challenges, one of them being wherever we encounter advertising, we're inclined to filter it out, right? We zap through it on our TiVo, or if we can't do that, we instinctively ignore it. This coupled with the fact that there's more advertising than ever out there trying to reach us makes it an extremely difficult proposition for advertisers to speak to audiences in the traditional ways that they have. And so the metaphor here is that these new product placement and buzz marketing strategies are the guerrilla warfare equivalent to what traditional advertising was in terms of conventional warfare, right? It was obvious. It was, it was clear in terms of where it appeared. And now it's trying to sort of blend in with the surroundings, whether that be, the media content that we like to consume from professionals or the kind of interpersonal and social media content that we consume from friends.
It's interesting, Mike, that we have this conflicted relationship, even with companies with whose products we feel pretty satisfied. Can you talk about what has fed that disillusionment by American audiences with traditional advertising forms?
Yeah, it's a good point, because certainly there are companies that I think are beloved and have been beloved. There are brands that people embrace and have embraced for a number of years. I think the central problem that we've seen is that it's simply become a cacophony in terms of the messages that advertisers are trying to reach us with. An often cited statistic that's quite frankly imprecise and may even be dated, but is that the typical consumer encounters perhaps 3,000 different advertisements in an average day nowadays. And that, that really speaks to just the sense of information overload that we're encountering. And you see this really with regard to, television migrating online and audiences sort of, becoming annoyed with the pre-roll ads that they have to sit through. Certainly in terms of, other media outlets, this has become a problem. And so I think really it's that kind of overload and clutter that currently kind of dominates the media landscape that contributes to this sense that we're just sort of tired of traditional messages coming at us in conventional ways.
You explore two approaches to advertising in the book. Some people might know the terms hard sell and soft sell. You use hot and cool sell. Can you explain the difference?
Sure, absolutely. So they actually sort of map onto each other in some interesting ways. The terms hot cell and cool cell, I'm actually borrowing from a somewhat famous sort of media theorist by the name of Marshall McLuhan. He was his heyday and his sort of intellectual heyday was back in the 1960s when he was writing some of his books. And he had a theory about media that basically you could sort of think of all types of media on a hot to cool kind of thermometer scale. And hot media are basically any type of media that provides a great deal of information and therefore doesn't require a lot of engagement or activity on the part of the audience. Cool cell, by contrast, are kind of low-definition media that require a great deal of activity or engagement on the part of the audience. So, you know, to kind of break that down in more simple terms, for example, you know, a college lecture would be something that's more of a hot medium, right? The audience is just expected to sort of take notes, whereas a kind of a seminar discussion is much more of a cool medium because the audience is the audience is anticipated and is addressed in a way that they're expected to contribute more to that process of meaning-making. So that maps onto, I think, a lot of these new techniques that we're seeing in terms of interactive and new media advertising. And similarly, if we think of kind of the hard sell, and you can sort of think here of sort of the classic Billy Mays infomercial on it, you know, one in the morning, or the experience of wandering into Times Square where, you know, thousands of blaring neon light advertisements are coming at you, that's kind of both the hard sell and, to me, the hot sell, right? And nowadays, what we're seeing more and more with some of the campaigns that I try to explore in the book is the idea that advertisers are increasingly addressing us as more active consumers, right? More active audiences that we're expected to sort of participate in the advertisement in some way. And this takes shape across a variety of formats that I explore in the book.
Okay, so tell me about this. I had an experience about a week ago, and I was so glad to be reading this book at the time. A friend posted on Facebook some video of this swimming pool that sort of starts as a patio and you press a button and it makes a 12-inch wading pool, and then it goes all the way down to 6 feet and it's this fancy thing. So I saw the video that my friend posted. And then, I mean, I can't afford a pool, but I had to go to the website of the company and look at this thing. Is that the idea that I'm being drawn in and made to believe that all this is my idea to go investigate this phenomenal product?
It is. It is exactly, yeah. And it is very much the idea that you are not, a message is not being forced upon you, but rather that you're discovering the advertising message in some way. And that goes back to kind of what we were talking about in terms of the sense of frustration among consumers, you know, that they're just being talked at a lot. And nowadays, you know, there's a great deal of, you know, there's a lot of buzzwords in the advertising industry where, you know, they speak about how they want to talk with consumers rather than at them. And so that moment of discovery where you were kind of playfully engaged to click through in that social media space to sort of discover what the advertisement is very much representative of the cool sell. And that can range from something, you know, as simple as, you know, forwarding an email along to taking part into some really fascinating and elaborate transmedia campaigns that, in particular, film studios and entertainment companies have been running in recent years. But the whole idea is that, you know, the more that they try to sell to you, the more resistant you are to being sort of told what to buy. And so in turn, you know, conversely, if you're able to sort of discover it, you know, serendipitously in some of these new media spaces, it's more convincing, it's more appealing to us as audiences.
This all feels very new to us, but you remind us here that people have been doing versions of guerrilla marketing in this country at least as far back as the 1920s.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, a lot of these techniques are growing in terms of importance, in terms of the you know, advertising spending outlays that are being put toward them. You know, just if we were to take both product placement and also buzz marketing, you can trace a really interesting backstory, a really interesting proto-history that leads up to you know, their increasing importance nowadays. In the case of, you know, product placement, I mean, you can go back to the early decades of film where, you know, there was a kind of a quid pro quo set up between brands that were hoping to get their products in films, and films, quite frankly, needing to fill out props and cars, you know, for the films. You can look back to the early decades of radio and television, which gave us the term soap opera, which soap opera is so named because detergent companies were originally financiers of these content. And then if you look at buzz marketing, which is essentially getting everyday folks to try out products and sort of talk them up with their friends. This, too, has a very long history going back to the 1920s. You can trace this back to the work of a very famous person, Edward Bernays, who's considered the father of public relations by many, and his efforts back in the 1920s to work through those same sort of buzz strategies. One of the most famous examples that he utilized was getting physicians to recommend bacon to their patients as a way to sell bacon. There's a kind of interesting, backstory to a lot of these techniques that, still are being deployed in new spaces in innovative ways, but do have some history behind them.
Why are we more likely to be swayed by word of mouth information or things that seem to come from our friends and colleagues than even the slickest, best produced ad?
It's a good question, and it's the fundamental challenge that advertisers have always tried to figure out. I mean, the fundamental thing is its trust. It's trust and its authenticity. I mean, there are few buzzwords that you hear thrown around more in the advertising industry than authenticity. And that's partly because, the nature of their business is contrivance. And so they're always trying to authenticate something that's otherwise, sort of unnatural in terms of trying to get us to do stuff, to buy stuff. And they know that our friends and our family are by far the most influential forces to get us to shop, consume, vote, any of these things. And this has been, established for decades of research that these are the most critical touch points in terms of, influencing and persuading folks. And so that, that speaks to why they're interested in trying to communicate to us through those folks. The problem is that it's just been hard to achieve that either at scale or, just in terms of the infrastructure to get everyday folks to talk to their friends about products that you want them to do. It's still difficult, but certainly thanks to the massive changes that we've seen over the past two decades with the internet and then more recently the rise of social media, that becomes more feasible to try and work into those word-of-mouth opportunities that advertisers have long known have been critical. And so even, as you say, the slickest, most beautifully produced ad still runs up against something that psychologists argue is basically an advertising schema, basically a kind of instinctive filter, a sort of BS blocker that we sort of put up, that we shield ourselves with, instinctively, reflexively, when we encounter anything that looks like advertising, because we know that advertising is in the business of selling us things that maybe aren't necessarily what we expect of them, right? I mean, you go in, the hamburger at the fast food joint doesn't look like the one that you see on the commercial, and we've been accustomed to that type of thing for years, for decades, depending on how old you are, and you just become you instinctively have a kind of a hermeneutics of suspicion, instinctively mistrusting where advertisers are trying to communicate.
Of course, it used to be that if my next door neighbor told me about an awesome new floor polish, I could probably trust her. But now it turns out she might be receiving compensation just for talking to me and the other neighbors about this.
Yeah, it's this phenomenon of buzz marketing, and it's increased in the past 10 years. The Word of Mouth Marketing Association was founded in 2004, really reflecting the industry growth in this area. So you have companies like Buzz Agent, which I think is the largest among them, that has about 500,000 folks, just everyday people, friends, neighbors, family, whatever, who basically receive free products, talk them up with friends, and then report back to the company on that dialogue. They're not paid necessarily to say it's the most fantastic thing ever, and these buzz marketing firms are very clear on that. But they do receive free stuff, and they sort of are expected to sort of get a sense of how it's playing in the everyday sort of the everyday social life of consumers out there beyond the traditional advertising approaches that has been taken.
Michael Serrazio is with us. He's assistant professor in the Department of Communication at Fairfield University and author of Your Ad Here, The Cool Sell of Guerrilla Marketing. You can join us at 800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Michael Serrazio is my guest. He teaches in the Department of Communication at Fairfield University, and he is the author of the new book, Your Ad Here, The Cool Sell of Guerrilla Marketing. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's talk a little bit more about BuzzAgent, which I think, as you mentioned, there are other companies that do the same thing. BuzzAgent is sort of the best known. For people who don't know, though, you can sign up to receive these samples online. Maybe you talk about them, but chances are you will only receive products if you give a lot of information and if you say a lot about them. You don't just get the chance to keep quiet.
Indeed, yeah. And I found this out because I, in the process of reporting and researching this book, I had signed up in the hopes of, you know, being drafted as a dutiful buzz agent of my own. And I found in that process that part of what they were looking for from me as a potential buzz agent was an incredible amount of information about my consumer activities and an incredible amount of opinions and sharing about exactly what I consume and where and why. And it you know, even though I was not ultimately asked to take part in one of their particular buzz campaigns, and that would have been something where I would have received a free product, you know, or a sample of a product, and I would have been asked to sort of talk about it with friends. I would have been given, as they put it, sort of suggested talking points to chat up the product with friends, and then you know, I'd be expected to file a buzz report, basically, about those interactions to sort of see how you know, how a given product was playing in my social circle. So I wasn't asked to take part in any of those. I suspect it may have been a question of, you know, sort of demographics, and I don't think that necessarily the campaigns they were running were looking for someone of my demographic background. But this is sort of what happens, you know, and as I understand it, for, you know, if a company, if a brand comes to BuzzAgent and seeks out, you know, buzz agents campaigning on its behalf, you know, they'll shoot to have, you know, numerous interactions like this, and they'll not only be, I mean, it's a dual thing where they're both sort of trying to seed the information about the product into social circles and also draw out kind of surveillance about sort of how the product is. It's kind of real life focus group setting in that regard, and so it kind of serves a dual purpose in that regard.
Lots of people these days are aware of the presence of product placement. Morgan Spurlock did a movie a few years ago. How did the use of Reese's Pieces in the movie E.T. help sort of make that an everyday thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's considered by many scholars to be sort of the turning point in the history of product placement. It had existed before that in the early 1980s when E.T. came out, but that was really the moment at which it became, you know, incredibly popular as a technique for really, you know, raising money and possibly persuading audiences about a particular brand. So famously, as the sort of legend is told, Spielberg had gone to M&M's, I think the parent company is Mars, and had asked, you know, I'm filming this movie, there's going to be a scene where we have to have a sort of candy pieces, and you know, would you be interested in taking part in it? And they took a pass on it. Ultimately, he went with Reese's Pieces, and again, as the legend holds, you know, famously sales for Reese's Pieces went up in the aftermath of that film. It was really at that point that you started seeing, you know, the explosion of product placement happen in film and TV in the decades since. The introduction and popularity of reality TV on network and cable television in the past two decades has been hugely important for the development of product placement, because entire shows are sort of built around products in this regard. I mean, you can you know, you can hear in the quotes from someone like Mark Burnett, who produced Survivor, basically, who says, you know, something like Survivor is ultimately just a marketing vehicle to sell the products that are sort of, you know, his storylines and contests contests are wrapped around within the show. And so you've seen this come about a lot more in film. And we can look at something like some of the James Bond films in that franchise have found it incredibly lucrative to do brand partnerships. Most recently, I think it was Heineken that paid something like $40 million or something to be featured in the latest Bond Skyfall installment. Film and television have always sort of taken advantage of product placement, but we're seeing more and more of it, and it's spreading across to other mediums like video games and pop music and so on.
Let's talk about video games with regard to the U.S. Army and the campaign that it did. Can you tell us about the, I guess it commissioned a game?
Yeah, it's a very fascinating story. So the U.S. military has struggled for a number of years in terms of its recruiting techniques to get young folks to sign up and join. And as I had a chance to interview some of the folks who were involved in this project called the America's Army video game, Basically, they told me that, by the time, they're sort of trying to recruit this potential, say 18-year-old person, people have already formed an opinion about the Army based upon, a decade and a half of pop culture exposure. And so, the classic kind of, Army recruiting tool that we think of is Uncle Sam with his, finger pointed
out. I want you, right.
At the subject. Yeah, exactly. I want you. And that's a classic hard sell. That's a very sort of classic kind of hot sell technique. You're really only being addressed by the Army in those, advertising circumstances for your acquiescence, What they then did in the early part of last decade was they developed this video game project. I mean, they knew that video games were, a natural kind of alignment. The history of the video game industry has long had, sort of shooter and war games in that regard. They've just been made by, sort of private, companies that make video games. So what the Army did was they created this game called America's Army. It was released about 11 years ago, I think. It's been incredibly popular, downloaded millions of times. They've done statistics on, they've run surveys on, what impact it's had on, high school and teenagers and young adults' opinions on the Army. And really, this is a classic example of really, a brand thinking of itself in terms of a space wider than a 30-second commercial. I mean, the message that the Army is trying to get across, which is, sign up, we want to recruit you, is really never present in something like a video game like America's Army, and yet it's also omnipresent, basically. This is another example of an incredibly interactive way of advertising to audiences. The Army can sort of monitor gameplay and get a sense of, what parts of the game or what parts of the Army might a particular, potential recruit like. How can we, tailor more toward that? And so it becomes a very sort of useful mechanism in terms of trying to deal with this challenge, which was, filling the ranks in terms of potential recruits for the Army.
So all of the things that we've talked about, for the most part, it's pretty clear, people may be more engaged with this content, but it's pretty clear where much of this comes from, that it's being generated by these companies. Something like a flash mob, which feels very much like performance art, it may not be apparent to people who are influenced by this content that it was produced with the intent of selling product.
Indeed, yeah. Yeah, the flash mob is an example in terms of kind of alternative culture of a way of the advertising industry trying to capitalize on kind of more out of home techniques that we would sort of more associate with sort of like I say alt culture. The history of the flash mob as I've been able to sort of trace it and understand it is it's maybe about a decade or so old and for listeners who maybe aren't familiar, it's essentially in its organic form and its non advertising form. It's basically a situation where you have, crowds of people who sort of descend upon a particular time and place to engage in usually some sort of quirky or strange or funny kind of social activity. So, one of the early, flash mobs that was pioneered in New York City involved, dozens, maybe hundreds of 20-somethings descending on, I think, F.A.O. Schwartz. And sort of bowing down to some particular like dinosaur toy there, right? Strange, quirky, weird, hey, whatever, it's what you do on weekends, it's all good. But what we've seen is that advertisers, have increasingly taken to some of those methods. And in the case of like a corporate flash mob, what we saw is about 5 years ago, T-Mobile, as a way of promoting their life is for sharing, brand campaign, they basically arranged for a kind of dance medley to be played out in a very crowded London metro station, and that then got huge viral traction online. It was sort of forwarded around a ton. And I think, in situations like that or in other cases where we've seen corporate graffiti sort of enacted, where we've seen, corporate street art, these are situations where they're very, sort of deliberately trying to blend in with a kind of alternative youth culture. And that's typically, I should say, the types of companies and brands that are chasing after, the types of consumers and audiences that these companies and brands are chasing after. It's usually young adults. It's usually teens, 20-somethings, things like that.
And it never hurts to seek out the cool kids in a particular high school and give them all a pair of the new sneaker you want to sell.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is another interesting historical example. Again, thinking about buzz marketing is something that just, didn't just appear in the last 10 years, but has a long history of product seeding behind it. You can look back to, some historical examples of where, teens have been enlisted in basically like peer-to-peer marketing, where, for example, they would sort of pay teens to rally around and scream for Frank Sinatra back in the 30s, or a particular root beer brand was very clever in targeting high schoolers in the 1950s. And then more recently, ad lore has it, Converse was extremely strategic in terms of seeding their sneakers among the most popular kids at a high school, at high schools in the 1980s. And nowadays, you still have that happening as well. You had a particular agency that I cover in the book called Girls Intelligence Agency, GIA, will arrange for to have sort of parties among popular girls that then they come together and there's usually a product introduced, and again they're sort of getting feedback on the product, and they're also sort of trying to sort of seed it among these groups, it's this whole school of thought that there are there are influential opinion leaders out there in each and every demographic, and if you're able to sort of reach out to them, the advertising industry assumes that's sort of where the magic happens and sort of where brands can achieve some viral popularity in that regard.
Of course, the risk of all this from the perspective of companies is that it could backfire, right? You could have a bunch of kids saying, I am not wearing these sneakers, I am not drinking this root beer, I am not using this lipstick or whatever.
Absolutely, and that's been one of the most interesting tensions to sort of watch in the advertising industry, because historically, and even still today, many would argue, it's important to be extremely disciplined about your brand message. It's important to maintain a great degree of control over what your brand image is, or to try and make sure that whatever advertising you're putting out there, the consumers are saying favorable and very precise things about the product. And naturally, when you put a product or a brand in the hands of some autonomous buzz agent or some cool kid at a high school somewhere, you ultimately can't control that. And so that tension between control and autonomy is something that we see playing out in the book in really interesting ways as it comes to buzz marketing. But also, actually, I would add, we can trace it back to product placement as well. When a brand signs up to have their car or sneakers or cola product featured in a film or television show, they are, giving up some degree of, control over what that will look like. And the way that plays out and some of the fights and sort of push and pull that kind of plays out with, who's really in charge of how the product or the brand will appear in the context of pop culture content is another really interesting area to study, because they have to give up inherently some control. And a lot of times, for example, in the case of a short film series about BMW that was released online, you have the car being sort of destroyed, and directors sort of having their way with, a product like that. And so that can be extremely unsettling for, for a company that's just paid a huge amount to have it featured in those spaces.
How much of a challenge is it for people who are engaged in guerrilla marketing to sell this to the corporate client who wants control over everything, who wants everyone to say this thing is fabulous, and not to be more, I don't know, honest might not be the right word, but more truthful about their experience?
It's extremely challenging, and it represents a tension and a cultural shift that you're seeing, I think, in the advertising industry in terms of those conversations that are happening, because one of the things that guerrilla marketers who work in this space often try to sell to brands and clients and companies that they work on behalf of is that, you know, it might not come out exactly as you want, but it will come out more authentically. So, you know, they'll contrast it, say, with the polished, 30-second spot, or again, if we think of Billy Mays as kind of the extreme opposite here, the perfectly delivered, almost kind of cheesy pitch. That the advertiser may have perfect control over what exactly is said about the product, but it won't the audience won't necessarily, that won't ring true, that won't ring authentic to the audience. And so, what I found in interviewing folks is that, if, for example, you're trying to seed a product among, let's say a laptop among bloggers, right? You've got a hot new laptop that your company is coming out with, and you're hoping for it to catch fire in the blogosphere. What they'll find is that actually if you sort of send the product out and you encourage bloggers to sort of be creative about it, what they're finding is actually that, if the product is popular and they do have confidence with it, that will actually, there'll be hundreds of thousands of different permutations of the ad message, because it'll be filtered through these individual autonomous networks. Whereas if they had just cut a 30-second spot, that 30-second spot looks the exact same to no matter how many audiences that are watching it. But, a word-of-mouth campaign filtered through bloggers is going to sort of evolve and be uniquely tailored and adaptive to the circumstances of a particular audience.
How does the cost of guerrilla marketing compare with what companies have spent in the past on traditional advertising and PR?
Sure. It's both way cheaper in a lot of cases and actually more expensive in others. Something like a buzz marketing campaign, or something like, as I was talking about earlier, some of the kind of street culture, kind of outdoor, corporate street art, corporate graffiti, flash mob type campaigns. Those are extremely cheap. I mean, those are not, very expensive outlays when it comes to a campaign or a brand. But on the other hand, when you start talking about trying to weave into pop culture, trying to locate your brand or product in film and television, that becomes quite expensive, and that becomes, that can occupy a huge cost when it comes to those things.
Michael Serrazio is with us. He's assistant professor in the Department of Communication at Fairfield University and author of the new book, Your Ad Here, The Cool Sell of Guerrilla Marketing. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Michael Serrazio of Fairfield University. His new book is called Your Ad Here, The Cool Sell of Guerrilla Marketing. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Fred, who wants to know, are there particular age groups that respond best to social media and guerrilla marketing antics?
Yeah, I think that the evidence to this point has shown that that in particular, kind of the 18 to 24 demographic, or teens, 20 somethings, that tends to be the group that is targeted most with some of these techniques, and that tends to be the types of demographics that brands and companies are after when they're trying to reach these folks. As I mentioned earlier, the America's Army game was very much targeted to sort of late teens, because that's sort of the optimal, age at which, the recruits can be enlisted for the Army. If you look at some other campaigns that we've seen with regard to, as we said, the kind of Converse sneakers, the Girls Intelligence Agency, those are aimed sort of at teen groups. And I think that there's just there's a sense that's particularly acute among advertisers, and I think it's backed up by some research as well, but advertisers seem to believe it themselves, is that, when you talk about cynicism of audiences, this is most acute among teens, college students, 20-somethings. I mean, these are supposedly the audiences and demographics that are most resistant to being spoken to in that hot sell, hard sell type fashion. These are the folks that most recoil, supposedly, when Uncle Sam is pointing their finger at them and sort of telling them what to do, or conversely, Billy Mays is telling you what type of blender to buy. And so I think that these types of techniques lend themselves toward those age groups particularly.
Is there any concern, Mike, that overuse of these tactics will somehow chip away even at the perceived legitimacy of word of mouth messages?
Yeah, there is. I mean, it's one of the interesting things to watch, especially as guerrilla marketing increasingly proliferates in the social media world. Facebook is going through a really interesting period right now. It's about a year, I think, almost a year to the date after they had their initial public stock offering. And one of the tensions for Facebook that I think they've always been trying to figure out, but now are under increasing pressure to figure out, is just how much advertising you can tolerate in these spaces. And at what point, if the advertising becomes too obvious, becomes too annoying, does that wind up contaminating, if you will, that space as a whole to try and locate advertising messages? And I think Facebook initially was extremely cautious about where it allowed advertising to show up in those spaces. And it was because it was so cautious that it probably became such an enticing, sort of fertile space for advertisers to try and, locate their viral messages in. And that's also due to just how much time folks, are spending with social media. And so the ways in which, Facebook and Twitter and some of the other social media spaces incorporate or resist guerrilla marketing advances on their turf will be really interesting to see, because without doubt, you can definitely burn something out in that regard. You can definitely oversaturate with ad content and sort of turn people off from your venue or platform.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with David in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great, thank you.
Good. I just had a kind of a comment about this kind of social marketing system. It doesn't really seem to make marketing better. It seems to just make social networking worse. I mean, we're all kind of, it's not like it's a secret that, it's not really a movement, right? It's just Dove soap. That kind of, it's not more authentic. It's just something on the side. I don't really fully understand the benefit to it.
What do you think, Mike?
Well, it's definitely, I think, a reaction, David, that a lot of probably other consumers share and a lot of other audiences share in that space, that that you're not adding anything necessarily that makes our experiences in the social media realm more enjoyable, and this is going to be a challenge for advertisers for sure. Now, to your question of whether we're authentically tricked that something can become a movement in these spaces that might actually have been the sort of behind the scenes sort of backstage machinations of a brand, that speaks too to the fact that advertisers are constantly trying to stay ahead of our kind of sophisticated sort of jaundiced cynicism about their messages. And so, does it add much to our experiences? Probably not, although, there are some examples in the book that, if you were a fan of a particular, say, movie franchise, I think for those folks it maybe has been enjoyable. But if it just looks, obviously like an ad, if it just comes across in a very sort of traditional staid manner, then I think you're correct. It just sort of junks up the space in that regard.
And of course, most people are aware that if we get, you know, a social media message that says, your friend Dennis loves Walmart, they didn't necessarily, my friend Dennis didn't say, hey, tell Chris Boyd I love Walmart. The person clicked like at some point along the way, and then the company has permission to put that back out there, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's so funny that you mentioned that, because I had at some point inadvertently myself clicked on something on Facebook that was, you know, that I liked a particular brand or company. I'm not sure. I don't recall what it was, but I remembered hearing some friends saying, dude, you're popping up in our news feeds, like, as, you know, as, you know, endorsing, like you say, you know, Walmart or Nike or something like that. And I was like, I don't even remember, like, clicking on it. You know, I mean, maybe I did, but it was possibly totally inadvertent. But that speaks to exactly kind of the ambition with regard to guerrilla advertising, right? That they want to sort of subsume us into their ad message. They want to find a way to make, you know, me or you or anybody the face of the brand, because as we said earlier, right, that is the most powerful way to cut through, you know, advertising clutter, commercial clutter. The most powerful way is to get somebody you know to become the face of that brand, and maybe that'll just push you just a little bit closer to making the sale.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. We have Judy Kay on the line in Dallas. Hi, Judy Kay.
Hi, Chris. Love your show.
Thank you.
I'm at an older generation, and I was just going to comment on one of my favorite commercials, or the undertone of commercial was Borden Milk and Elsie the cow, that she was so pure. She wasn't married. She had a nephew named Beauregard, and she didn't do any other thing, and she was just pure and sweet. And we, it seems to me back in those days, we were more loyal to products. I mean, if your grandmother said, oh, Mrs. Olson, I use Folgers, you stuck with it. Mm. Nowadays, it's, stuff is so cheap, and you just go, oh, what the heck, and just move on. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for the call and the comment. And yeah, it's a great point. You know, the I think that you could possibly make the case that that audiences and consumers and citizens were perhaps more loyal and less cynical of institutions in general years ago, and advertising is in some ways you know, just sort of swept up in that kind of sort of same cynicism toward you know, toward large scale institutions, whether they be, you know, political, social, religious, what have you. And so, yeah, I mean, and it's funny too, because when you go back and you look at advertising from 50 years ago, or, you know, even, you know, 75 years ago, it does sort of speak to the viewer in a much more, and I think the term that the caller used was sort of pure way. You know, it seems to come to us from a you know, a less sophisticated, less cynical time, perhaps you know, a moment where you know, perhaps because you know, the medium was new, or you know, consumers hadn't yet been jaded by decades of sort of advertising abuse and you know, being talked out of, or, you know, finding out that the burger, you know, at the fast food joint didn't look like what it was supposed to. You know, perhaps that was why it could have been a pure advertising message and cultivated greater loyalty among followers and consumers and fans.
How does all this relate to the way that political campaigns advertise? Because obviously they've always had a very significant element of sort of grassroots promotion of what they believe in, their ideas and their candidate. And now, of course, they're also trying to do this in more professionalized ways.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's funny you mentioned that's been sort of my more recent kind of research project has been looking into, you know, the strategies and campaign tactics in the political realm, and had the opportunity in the fall to really engage in some research on this topic. And as you say, yeah, it's definitely something that candidates and politicians are trying to you know, accustom themselves to just as much as brands and companies. And what we're seeing, I think, is a lot of this, you know, the same you know, the same sort of patterns and tactics show up. You know, for just to give one example, you know, for example, you know, Twitter was increasingly used in the last election as a kind of surveillance tool for campaigns. So you had, particularly at the higher levels, so you're talking the presidential level, congressional levels, you had campaigns where operatives and strategists were monitoring really almost on an hour-to-hour basis exactly what kind of the news cycle was trending toward. You're monitoring, you know, opposition rivals, you know, in a given, you know, election or campaign. And so social media is absolutely becoming sort of central in some really interesting ways to the political advertising world as well.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Michael on the line in Richardson. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Chris. Love your show.
Thank you.
I was wondering how the advertisers or marketers or companies exploit when some sort of a tragedy happens, like in the case of the man that rescued those women that had been held hostage for 10 years and he mentioned McDonald's. Or like the Trayvon Martin case, where I think I read that the sale of Skittles went up. How do they exploit that?
Well, it's a great, thank you for the call. It's a great question. It is, and it's an extremely challenging thing for advertisers to try to react to. Certainly, if we were to get, you know, the marketers on the phone for those examples that you cite, they would do everything in their power to avoid using that word exploit. But they do so, I think, cautiously, and they tread carefully. I think in the case of tragedies, generally speaking, advertisers sort of assume an extremely careful posture, a posture that just tries to sort of mourn if mourning is necessary, that kind of strikes a patriotic tone if such things are necessary. If you are talking about also kind of, real-time marketing opportunities, those have been really interesting as well. And it's less of a tragic thing, but for example, during the Super Bowl, when the lights went out for, 20, 30 minutes or whatever it was, you had a couple of different companies campaign on, who managed to put in kind of in just real-time reaction Twitter messages about that sort of linked the brand to what was happening in very clever ways. It got a lot of retweeting, traction. You're absolutely right. They're trying to react to real-time events. They're trying to try and take the pulse of the zeitgeist, if you will, when big things happen. But if it's something tragic, I think in general, there's an element of cautiousness that advertisers generally try to take into account. So,
Mike, is there a lot of discussion among the folks who do this professionally about the importance, from an ethical standpoint, that guerrilla marketing efforts be at least somewhat transparent?
Absolutely. There's no shortage of language about transparency when it comes to all the different varieties of guerrilla marketing that we talked about today, but particularly when it comes to buzz marketing and social media marketing. They are very explicit and very forthright about wanting to make it clear that what they're doing is advertising. As a sort of critic and observer, I find that very ironic because part of what they sell to clients is the premise that if you go with a buzz campaign or if you go with a social media campaign rather than a traditional campaign, it's more likely to be convincing and persuasive and you're more likely to be able to speak to audiences because it doesn't look like advertising, right? I mean, the crux of the book is basically an argument that the less something looks like advertising, the more advertisers think that it will be effective in these examples. And so, without a doubt, I take them at their word that they do try to sort of make transparency clear, but it goes against at the same time what they're selling as far as why it's effective. I mean, if something, if we're hanging out with a friend and he or she is talking up a particular, brand of sneakers and then it sort of finishes with a brought to you by, kind of caveat, that's pretty stilted. I mean, that's pretty weird. I mean, like I said, I wasn't able to become a buzz agent myself, but I think I would just found that plainly awkward. There is a great deal of effort towards transparency, but to me, it's an ironic and probably just kind of ostensible thing to include because of just the nature of what these advertising strategies suggest.
Michael Serrazio is assistant professor in the Department of Communication at Fairfield University. His new book is Your Ad Here: The Cool Sell of Guerrilla Marketing. Mike, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thanks so much for the opportunity to talk to you, Chris. I really appreciate the time.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had Joe Bilotti on the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Send comments to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.